they put in that coffee y'all drinking. I need to get me some. I'm Hector, and I'm an alcoholic. And I love drugs. Particularly this little white rock called crack cocaine. Y'all heard of it? Y'all know what I'm talking about? Okay, I'm in the right room then. It's an honor to be here. I'm really nervous. I don't have an agenda. I'm going to trust that God is going to use me tonight. I prayed like 3 times already. you know, just let me say this. If you don't hear anything else tonight, hear this. I'm standing up here tonight in front of you guys and ladies to tell you that by the grace of God in this program and Austin Recovery and Cocaine Anonymous, I've been sober since May 26, 2002. Yeah. And that, to me, that is a freaking miracle, because when I was sitting in those chairs, actually we didn't have this in 2002. We had the meetings over there in the cafeteria. But when I was sitting in those chairs, like you, some of you are, not all of you, but some of you are, I couldn't see 60 days sober, you know. I just couldn't, because I had tried for so long to do the right thing. And, you know, just like the book says, every attempt, there was another failure, you know. So just a couple of things real quick. I did mention Cocaine Anonymous. That's home for me. That's where I got sober. That's where I've done all my service with Cocaine Anonymous. I continue to do my service with Cocaine Anonymous. You know, I go to a couple of treatment centers to carry the message, and I carry the Cocaine Anonymous message. Some of you are familiar with it, some of you are not. We use this same book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So just real quick, if I say anything that offends you or you don't agree with it, I'll ask a favor. Please don't hold it against Cocaine Anonymous or any 12-step fellowship. Hold it against myself. If I say anything that contradicts this book, I'm wrong and the book is right. So anything I say that is not in this book, it's just my opinion, and you can discard it. Actually, you can discard anything I say. It doesn't really make a difference. You know, I'm not here to convince anybody. You know, I'm not here to tell anybody how you should work your program or what you should do in recovery. I have no idea. I have no idea. Sometimes I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. So, some of these things I've had to learn the hard way. You know, sometimes I think that I have some kind of power because I've been sober this long, and I can tell somebody. You know, I can give advice to somebody, and you know, the truth is that I don't know what you're gonna need. You know, on any given experience, whether it's relationship. Financial, especially relationships. Don't ask me for advice on that one. financial. Don't ask me for advice on that one either. I'm not very good at that one either. I came through here in 2002 because I was facing homelessness, but I want y'all to know something. I didn't come here to get sober, you know. I came here because my ass was on fire, you know, and I was really scared to be homeless. I never been homeless, so I came in here and I was full of shame, full of guilt. You know, I just couldn't believe that it had gotten to this, and or that I've come this far, you know, and I honestly, part of me wanted to be here, but part of me did not want to be here. And something else that I learned about a year into my sobriety is that I used to think that I made the decision to come in here, but I heard a speaker say he had nothing to do with the decision. It was God. And when I look back at my experience, you know, it was absolutely God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I want to talk a little bit about this powerlessness, right? On step one, it talks about being powerless. Well, so I'm going to say this, and again, you know, you can agree with it, or you don't have to, but if I say anything that you know, strikes a chord or somehow, you know, bothers you, you know, you may want to take a look at it, because there might be some truth. You know, every time that somebody says something that perhaps I don't like, or even the way the tone that person used or whatever it is, you know, something's wrong with me, because I'm not accepting that person for the way they are. You know, I'm thinking that person needs to be different. You see what I'm saying? And so something I wholeheartedly believe is that when you're truly done, that's it. You're not going to look back. I promise you. I believe that. I believe in being done. And but you have to come to that decision on your own. And I remember, you know, coming to that decision, you know, and it was scary. And it was very scary, but I'm glad I did. I'm glad that I was there, and I'm glad that it happened for me, because what I know today is that in the admission of powerlessness, I get empowered. Something happens to me in the big book it only talks about powerlessness, right? But in the 12 and 12, there's another book called The 12 and 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, which Bill wrote, you know, after. Okay, so the big book was written kind of in a hurry for public acceptance. Now, this is true. You can look in the history. So the big book was written kind of in a hurry because, you know, they wanted public acceptance. But so Bill took his time and wrote The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, right? And if you have read this book, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, you will see how he expands on each step, right? And so in step one, on the 12 and 12, it says something very interesting. It says, we admitted complete defeat, right? Complete defeat, you know? And there used to be a counselor that worked here, and I remember when he did his lectures, he would use the surrender as in war, right? Like when you're fighting in a war, and then, you know, you see that the enemy is winning, and you surrender, right? You put your weapon down, right? And you don't go back 30 minutes later and say, you know, and pick it up again, right? But what do you win? What do you win when you surrender in a war? Huh? Life, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's the same thing with recovery, right? What do I get in this surrender process? I'm going to get a brand new life. See, because I didn't have a life. When I came into this place, I didn't have a life, man. Austin Recovery, Cocaine Anonymous, has given me a life. And not just a life, but a purpose. You know, and this is one of the reasons why I continue to do this, because I know today, it's not all about me, you know, and it hasn't been. It hasn't been. When I worked the steps, I was 60 days sober, okay, 60 days sober, and my sponsors. I had an immense list, and he asked me, which ones can you start making now? So I had them, you know, we categorized them. I went, you know, to the ones where I didn't have to pay any money. and they were here in Austin, they were local. So I said, I can start with this ones. And he said, okay, why don't you do those four or five and start with that. And I said, okay, I can do that. And he said, from now on, he said, I want you to start raising your hand at meetings to sponsor others. And I'm like, whoa, hold on. I said, I don't think I'm ready for that. And he said, yeah, you are. And I said, well, how do I know if someone comes up to me and says, hey, you know, will you be my sponsor? I said, what do I do? And he said, you do the same thing we've been doing. You sit down, you do a prayer, you open the book, you read, and you share your experience. And I was like, okay. He made it sound so easy. And I said, okay. And this man hadn't lied to me, you know, up to this point. So I said, okay. And then he said something that changed, you know, forever my outlook on recovery. And this is what he said. He said, another thing. I said, what? He said, from now on, you don't go to meetings for you anymore. And I'm like, what? Like, what are you talking about, dude? And he goes, yeah, he goes, you don't go to meetings for you anymore. He said, you don't go to a meeting to see what you can take out of the meeting. You go to a meeting to see what you can bring to the meeting. And I tell you, that little simple attitude has given me so much, because, you see, when I go to a meeting to see what I can bring to the meeting, I try to go, you know, with the intention of being of service, you know. Guess what? 99%, well, maybe that's a lie. 97% of the time, I'm not disappointed of any meetings. You know why? Because I don't go in there with an expectation that it's going to do something, that it's going to treat something inside of me. Now, don't get me wrong. The meetings are very important, and they're absolutely part of recovery. You know, it's one of the things that's going to allow me to continue on this journey, right? But meetings alone, if I'm dependent on a meeting to make me feel better, it's the same thing as depending on my sponsor or any other human being, right? They're going to let me down. I'm going to be disappointed. I know I didn't talk much about my childhood. I grew up in a very loving family. I have five older brothers, two older sisters. I was born and raised in Mexico. I don't know if y'all been able to tell. I have an accent. I grew up in a border town. I moved across the border at the age of 10. I started going to school, and so it was very difficult. You know, I had to learn a new culture and, you know, a new language. And maybe it wasn't as difficult, you know, because everybody spoke Spanish. But still, I had to learn different things, and I had to adopt, and I started using drugs at a very young age because they were there. They were so easy to get, you know. Kids in school had drugs, downers, weed, cocaine, you know, and you had all these. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. You know, you had all these kids that were all, you know, they were all, their dads were all drug dealers, and they all had money. So, you know, these kids, man, they come into school with eight balls in their pocket, you know, like it was nothing, you know. And that's what we did, you know. That's what, I went to school to go in the bathroom at 7 a.m. to go snort a couple of lines of cocaine, you know, maybe pop some downers and be stupid all day, right? And act stupid and thinking that was cool. I had no idea what I was doing. All I can think of was like trying to be a man, you know, wanting to be a man. And I remember looking up to these guys that, you know, older guys and to the drug dealers, you know, and they had the money and the flash, you know, the chains and the cars and, you know, and I wanted that, you know, I was attracted to that. And needless to say, I never did become a drug dealer. And I thank God because I would probably have been my best customer. Like the closest I got to doing any kind of drug deal was like just flipping, you know, like taking a little bit out, like, you know, I'll go get an 8-ball and, you know, I put $20 in my pocket and take a little bit out of the bag, you know. Anyway. Or I just wouldn't come back at all. And then I had to come up with some kind of story, right, that I didn't even believe. So I moved to Austin because my family, I started smoking crack cocaine at the age of 15. And so they didn't know what to do with me. You know, for 3 years, I mean, I drove them crazy. And at the age of 15, my family, when they found out, they were actually very concerned. You know, they were not mad. They were actually very concerned. And I was actually offered help. You know, they were concerned and they asked me if I wanted to go to rehab. And I'll tell you right now, when I look back at that, I'll never forget the day. And when they asked me that question, I looked at them and I was like, what? Rehab? I was offended, you know? Because you see, in my mind, rehab was for the guy under the bridge, you know? You know, like somebody that didn't take a shower for days. But see, I couldn't see that's where I was heading because I was already not, you know, I had long hair, nappy hair from not showering for 3 days sometimes in a row. But see, I couldn't see that. You know, I couldn't see that. There's a story in here of this guy. His name is Bill W., right? And he was one of the co-founders. And I remember when I started reading Bill's story and I'm thinking, what do I have in common with this dude? He's an alcoholic, stockbroker, educated, you know, from the 1930s, right? I'm a crack cocaine addict from 2000, you know? Like, what can I possibly have in common with this guy? And when my sponsor said, I want you to read Bill's story, and I want you to highlight if you felt, thought, or acted like Bill. See, he never said anything about drinking. He said, if you felt, thought, or acted like Bill. And let me tell you, I'm all over Bill's story. And this dude says, one of the lines in his story, he says, how blind had I been? How blind had I been? I couldn't see the reality. You know, I was in such delusion, right, that I still thought, oh, another line that he says, he says, I needed, when I woke up in the morning, I needed a bottle of gin and how many bottles of beer? Anybody? Man, y'all haven't been studying, have you? A half a dozen bottle of beers. If I were to eat any breakfast, he says, right? And then he says, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. Right? And that's how it was. That's how it was because, man, all I wanted was, I just wanted to relive that first time I got high, you know, when it was fun. Oh, man, I wanted to relive that so bad that I kept destroying my life in the chase of this euphoria or whatever you want to call it, you know. And I couldn't see the reality. I couldn't see what I was doing to myself. I couldn't see what I was doing to my family, to others. I mean, I was affecting everybody, you know. I was affecting everybody, and I just couldn't see it because, you know, I was the victim. I was the victim. And they didn't understand me. Anybody can relate to that? And you know what? They don't. They don't understand this, you know. So fast forward. my sponsor and grand sponsor, they used to come pick me up, and So for like 3 months when I got out of rehab, I couldn't find a job. And so I go to an AA meeting at noon. I jump in the bus and I go to an AA meeting. And then they used to come pick me up in the afternoons, and we go to a CA meeting up north, a Club 101, because back then I don't think we had any meetings in South Austin. I think there was one meeting on Monday nights in South Austin. And that first week when I got out of here, back then they weren't so strict with the rules. So that first week when I got out, they started coming, you know, they started coming to get me, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday they came and got me. But instead of going up north, we start heading farther south. You know, from South Austin, we start heading south. And I go, where are we going? And my grand sponsor looked at me and smiled. And he goes, we're going to a meeting. And I go, where? Excuse me. And he said, we're going to the ranch. Do they still call it the ranch? Okay. He said, we're going to the ranch. And I said, cool. You know, but I'm scared, right? And I said, cool. And he said, and you're going to talk to these guys. And I'm like, whoa, what? He goes, yeah, you're going to talk to these guys. And I said, what am I going to tell them? I said, I've only been out for a week. You know, I don't have anything to share. And he said, well, he said, you can tell them what you've been doing this week. I mean, you know what? Thank God for this man that God put in my life. Because you know what? They would throw me under the bus. They would. And they would not let me get away with anything, you know? I mean, if I walked out of the meeting, they would chase me and say, what are you doing? Why are you walking out of the meeting, you know? And that's just how it was, you know? That's how I grew up, okay? That's the kind of sponsorship I have. And I feel fortunate because, you know, I know today what it means to be respectful, you know, at a meeting. I don't try to use my phone while I'm at a meeting. You know, I don't answer my phone unless it's an emergency. To me, a meeting is sacred. You know, it's an hour that we have to possibly help save someone's life. That's how serious it is, you know. And so I know it's easy. And don't get me wrong, I've done it. I've gotten on my phone. I'm not saying I don't never do it. I said I try not to. But, you know, it's so easy for me to forget why I'm here, right? Like all of a sudden, and here's the thing. Think about it. Some of you are here tonight because you came to socialize, right? Yeah, you don't have to admit it. That's okay. I know you are, though, because I've done it. I've done it. You know, it's so easy for me to start complaining about the meetings, right? Because of this or because of that. Why am I there? Am I there to make friends? No. Am I there to rate other people or their behaviors? No. I'm there to carry I'm there to do one thing and one thing only, to carry the message to the alcoholic or the addict who's still suffering. That's it. That's my only responsibility, you know? So we came out here, and I was able to do volunteer work, and I haven't stopped since. You know, I've been doing it since that day. Not always here. I've been able to go to other facilities, and you know, man, any time that I'm welcome anywhere, you know, it's awesome, right? Because that wasn't always my experience. You know, it was the contrary. I was always asked to leave. Like, they show me the door. They say, hey, why don't you get out of here? Even my own family. You know, this is true. My family would have some kind of get-together, and they call me on the phone, and they say, hey, we're having a little get-together. We don't want you to come. We want you to stay away. Damn. I want to share something that happened to me early in recovery because I think it's important. I hope that maybe if you're new and something like this happens to you, I hope not, but, you know, I don't want you to be discouraged, but I believe in, and this is something else that I was taught, you know, when I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't talk about drugs. When I go to Cocaine Anonymous, I can talk about whatever, because it's cocaine and all other mind-altering substances, so it doesn't really matter. But here's something that happened to me, and I was, I don't know, like 3 months sober, 4 months sober, and I was at this AA meeting with my sponsor and my grand sponsor, and there's this guy, and he was sharing, and he said, this is exactly what he said. And I'm sitting in front of this guy, right? So he's like looking at me, and he goes, if you have a problem other than alcohol, you need to go somewhere else. And I was like, whoa. Like, this month, who does he think he is? He'd be telling me to go somewhere else, right? So, of course, we get in the truck, and, you know, the first thing I want, you know, I want to talk bad about this guy, right? I want to gossip because I didn't like what he said. He offended me, right? And I go, hey, did you hear what that guy say? And my grand sponsor, I'll never forget, he always used to do that. He'd look back at me, I'd be on the back seat, and he'd turn around and he'd give me this little smile. And he goes, you talking about Mitchell? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you know what he was trying to say, Hector? You know what he was really trying to say, Hector? I go, no? What was he really trying to say? He said, what he was saying is, if you have a problem other than alcohol, you're welcome here. But there's other places that can help you better. And I go, he didn't say that. And he goes, no, but that's what he was trying to say. And I thought about it for a minute, and I was like, okay, I can go with that. And this man helped me change my perspective about this other man. And so, you know what? I was able to not only thank this man for helping me see something in me that I didn't like, but I was also able to have more respect for him for standing up for the fellowship. Now, whether I agree with it or not, whether I like the tone he used or not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He did what he thought he needed to do. Right? And so, you know, thank God for good sponsorship. Thank God for this man that God put in my life. Another thing that happened to me early in my recovery, has anybody participated in a group conscience? Yeah. One little thing can go for 30 minutes, right? I mean, we can argue about damn chips for 30 minutes or whatever, or spending $2. Well, I was at a group conscience one time, and again, I don't remember exactly how sober I was, 6 months, 7 months, I don't know. But I was at a group conscience, and I got mad because I was convinced that they were making the wrong decision, you know, because I didn't agree with it. So, of course, I leave that meeting and the group conscience, and I'm mad as hell, and, you know, the first thing I do is I call my sponsor, and I talk to my sponsor, and he said, well, why don't you pray about it? And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever, dude, you know. And, you know, and what I'm doing is I'm looking for somebody that's going to agree with me, right? Because I want to be right, damn it. Feels good to be right, doesn't it? The truth hurts, you know. And so I talked to a bunch of people. I mean, you know, 4 or 5, and everybody, you know, had good advice. You know, everybody, oh, let me tell you about my experience. And I'm like, I want to hear your damn experience. I want you to say, yeah, man, they were wrong. How dare they, you know? And so I talked to my great grand sponsor. And this man was like, I mean, he was so calm. You never see him, you know, he never raised his voice. You know, you never see him snap at anybody. I mean, he was just the calmest dude you can, you know, he's like a monk. And I remember talking to him, and I'm like, you know, outside of the meeting, after the meeting, and he's just, you know, listening to me, like, real polite. He's like, mm-hmm, shaking his head, listening. Okay. And then I go, when I was done telling him, I go, what do you think, Jaime? He goes, well, let me ask you one question, Hector. I go, what? Do you believe God was present in that group conscience? And I was like, what? You must have misunderstood. And I was like, oh, man. When he said that to me, I knew he had me, you know. I was like, damn, yes, I do believe God was present in that group conscience. Well, so then the group conscience went exactly the way it was supposed to, you know, whether I agree with it or not. Doesn't matter. So, what I've been doing in the last 15 years, a lot has happened. I've been able to go back to school. Now, let me say something else. Because everything I have today, I'm stealing this from a speaker. I'm going to use it because I like it. Everything I have today and everything that I am today is a gift from God in this program. It really is. You know, like almost all the good opportunities, like as far as like jobs and stuff, have come through someone in these damn rooms, you know. And a lot of times I wasn't even looking for it. Sometimes somebody came up to me and they saw something in me that I couldn't see. And they said, hey, man, you know what? Why don't you come work for me? You know, why don't you, you know. And I'm like, okay, you know. And people in here, there was this old guy, and he actually used to call himself Goofy Alcoholic. I don't know if anybody remembers him. His name is Nick. And he used to be a volunteer out here. You remember Nick, Goofy Alcoholic? And this dude, this dude went back to school at the age of 50, right? And he went all the way to graduated with master's. And he's a professor now at UT, I think, in San Antonio. Well, he was at the time. I don't know what he's doing now. I haven't seen him in a long time. But the point is that when I got out of here, my sponsor, my second sponsor, actually, my first two sponsors relapsed on me. But my second sponsor was going to school. He was getting his GED. And I'm a high school dropout. And I was like, maybe I can go get my GED. And so I did. I went and got my GED. And then I went to school. I started a career as an electrician. And I went to trade school. And I did 4 years of trade school, which is equivalent to a bachelor's degree. And, you know, I'm really grateful, man. I'm really grateful. And let me tell you, that job came to me. It wasn't my decision to become an electrician. It was God. And I'll tell you why. Because at that time, when that happened, I had been complaining for 3 months about my job, right? And how much I didn't like my job. And so I leave my job. This was in 2007. So I left my job at the time, and I'm on a red light, and my head starts going, yeah, man, I need to find another job, man. And then this thought came to me, which I know it was God, and this thought was, why don't you do what you always wanted to do? Because ever since I was a kid, I don't know why, but since I was little, I remember I wanted to be an electrician. So the thought came to me, why don't you do what you always wanted to do? And I was like, yeah, why don't I, right? And this truck pulls right next to me, and it's from an electrical company, right? And I looked, Titus Electric, and there's this big phone number, and I'm like, okay, God, this must be you. So I dialed the number. I went and did an interview. 2 weeks later, I was working for that company, right? And so I started my career as an electrician. Now, let me tell you, when I started working as an electrician, I never said to myself, I want to become an electrician because I want to make so much money. I didn't, you know? But in the past couple of years, because of the demand here in Austin, you know, with construction and everything, in the last 2 years, I have been able to obtain an $8 raise, and so I'm not saying this to, you know, tell you, look at me. I promise you I'm not. I'm saying this because these things would not have happened if it wasn't for a loving God in my life. And I know that today, you know. And it, you know, it blows me away, man. Like, you know, I'm making almost $30 an hour, you know. Another thing I've been able to do, and I'm only sharing this again because this is my testimony that something bigger than me is definitely in my life. And I bought a house in 2011. I had to sell it because I bought it with my ex, and her name was on the loan, and she kept bugging me. She wanted to get her name off the loan. So I sold the house. We sold the house, and, you know, because I couldn't refinance, and whatever, that was done. And I actually went and signed some papers today to buy a new house. On my own, damn it. and it's exciting and it's scary because I don't do the adult thing. I'm still learning. I've been doing this thing for 15 years and you know what? I still make mistakes. You know, I still get scared. I still hurt people. And I have to live with that sometimes. Because recently, a few months ago, this is hard to share. But a few months ago, there was a woman in my life that I really loved. And I said some things, some hurtful things. Excuse me. And I can't take them back, you know. And I have to live with that. And maybe one day God will give me the opportunity to make amends. But it'll be in His time. So what do? I continue to move forward because, again, this life is not about me anymore. God needs me. God needs each and every one of us. Why do you think He put you here? Why do you think He put you here? Why do you think He's giving you another opportunity? Because He needs us, man. You know how many people die daily from this disease? And here we are, and we have an opportunity of a lifetime. Don't piss on it. Please. Take your life back. Hell, start a brand new life. Because if you were anything like me, you probably didn't have a life either. I don't know. Maybe maybe y'all are different. I hear that all the time, right? You don't understand. I'm different. No, I do understand. I have 5 minutes, so I need to wrap it up. I'll share one more thing that it was pretty powerful to me that happened while I was going through this, through the breakup. And it was hard. I wanted to be depressed. I wanted to stay in bed. I couldn't stay in bed. I have responsibilities, you know. I have, you know, thank God. You know, I want to look at it as a bad thing that, oh, man, like, I'm a foreman now. At work, I can't just call in sick. I have to be there to run this damn job, right? And so I can look at it as a bad thing because I can't call in sick, or I can look at it as a good thing because it's forcing me to get out of my comfort zone. It's forcing me to do something I believe I can do when in reality I can't. You know? And so the choice is mine. It's all about our own perspective of things, right? And sometimes it's hard to find the positive, don't get me wrong. But it's there, I promise. You just have to look harder sometimes. Anyway, so I've been going to this treatment center to carry the message on Saturdays, and there was this girl that I met on my first year of sobriety, right? And she came up to me the first time I saw her. She came up to me and she goes, "Hey, you remember me?" I was like, "Yeah." She goes, "I met you at so and so meeting, you know, however many years ago." And I was like, "Wow, yeah." And she was there as a client. And so I share about, so like a couple of Saturdays went by, and I share about going through that difficult, you know, rough spot, whatever you want to call it. And this guy, so after I shared, and then I opened it up for questions, and this guy asked me a very tough question. He said, "So what do you look forward to? How do you get through this?" And I said, I had to think about it, and I was like, I said, "Well," and the first thing I said was, "Well, you know what? It's not about me anymore." I said, "There's people that I need to help." I said, "I have a lot of responsibilities. I work." I said, "And my mom." I said, "I could not put her through what I put her through for 10 years. Not again." And that girl came up to me at the end of the meeting. And she said, "Thank you for staying sober this long." And I was like, "There's the answer." And it was God talking to me. Thank y'all for letting me share.